narrowing them down to what is the most relevant to what I want to say. And I do that usually a day or two before it's time for me to speak. Well, some of us do it day of, Cameron. But when I sat down yesterday to start writing what I wanted to say, I found that I apparently forgot to save the notes this time. They were gone, and needless to say, I was pretty excited about that. I wanted to talk to you about how I'm bad at talking because I never have the right word, even though I have a large enough vocabulary that I take some measure of pride in it. But I don't have access to those words when I need them. I was going to talk about the difference between that, between what I'm doing now and the speech I'm giving you now and speaking normally. I have words usually at these times because I prepared them. They're planned. They're ready to go. I even had some cool tie-ins and a really cool quote from a book that Dave, again, provided me with. I was going to talk about eloquence and that I have none, and then speaking effectively, which I rarely do, but that's all gone now. So when I was going through my notes, trying to find them, going through everything I have written down, and there's this thing I do where during a sermon or during a class or a devo, if I have this thought that just kind of like hits me a weird way, I write it down. I pull out my phone, I make a note, and then I just put it away, and every now and then I go back to them. And that's actually usually where my ideas to speak here come from. If I find some that I like a lot, I'll talk to Dave about them. He'll be like, that's probably not something with enough meat to speak about, or yeah, that's a really good one, or something along those lines. But I started going over them myself yesterday, and I didn't feel like any one of them was big enough to talk about, so instead, what I'm going to do is take you on a little tour through my brain. So I just have a few of the ones I thought were maybe not the most relevant, but maybe thought-provoking in some way. So what I'm going to ask for you guys is that I'm going to share some of these, and I want to hear back from you how they affect you. So the things I say are not me preaching to you. My thoughts can be so wrong that you want to laugh at me. They may miss the target by just a little bit, or maybe, if I'm really lucky, they might put words to something you feel, or we might find the answer to a question I pose. So the first note I have written down says this exactly. There is a strange dichotomy to being a Christian. I am a sinner who deserves hell, but I am made righteous through Christ. I don't make a note of what was happening or who was saying what when I write these down. They're completely out of context. But what thoughts does that give you? Am I crazy? Do you agree? Do you disagree? What does somebody think? I work...
Read Romans 7. Paul struggles with exactly the same thing. I have the good I want to do, but I don't do that. I'm a sinner, but yet I'm in the grace of God, so you're right there with Paul.
I love it. I gave my script to Joe before I started today, just so he could kind of help me twist it, make it a little more effective. And he left a note on this one. He says, Jesus talks about being in the world, but not of the world. It's like we're forced to live a dual lifestyle of sinning, but since we are Christ's possessions, we get heaven because Jesus offers us his reward and holds back what we do deserve. And now for what I think about it. I find this grounding in a way. On the one hand, it reminds me that I don't deserve anything from God. He was and is to come, but I'm going to probably be dead within 100 years. But none of that matters because he doesn't care. It's enough for him that I love him and choose to obey and follow him. My second thought reads, Jesus knows everything, but he still picked Judas Iscariot as one of his apostles. How could he live around and love the man that he knew would throw him to the wolves? What do you guys think?
He knew it had to be done.
Oh, I love it. That was awesome.
Why did he create us in the first place if he knew we were going to screw up and we're going to eat the fruit we weren't supposed to eat? Right?
Created us with free choice, yeah. So I still don't believe I have an answer for this, but it's exemplary to me of how much stronger just God's love is than everything I am. It's a number of years ago now. I don't remember even when. My breakup with the last girlfriend I had, which is a long time ago. I was still recovering from it, and a friend of mine, a lot of you guys know this story, his name is Brian, he started dating her while I was still recovering, and that really, really hurt me. And I couldn't even think about him without being angry. It's the only time I've ever really wanted to physically hurt someone. And he didn't even come close to threatening my life. I didn't talk to him for months, yet Jesus was around Judas every day, and as far as our records show, doesn't treat him any differently whatsoever. My third thought reads as such. Comparison of eternity to mortality. In the movie In Time, the poor are under pressure of time just like us. The rich are free from worry about it and get to move slow and enjoy life. So let me go back and explain just a little bit about the premise of this movie. So the movie In Time shows a dystopian future where everyone stops aging at the age of 25, and they have an amount of time imprinted on their wrist right here, years, days, months, hours, minutes. At the end of every day, the poor people, when they're clocking out, are charged with 24 hours so they can come back to work. The rich have hundreds of years on their wrist. So it shows, over the course of the movie, you see poor people are always moving quickly. They're rarely in lines. They're rushing as fast as they can to get everything done because they don't have time. They don't know if tomorrow's ever going to be. But the rich, they don't care. They go to casinos and gamble away tens of years at a time because, I don't know, what else am I going to do with it? I don't really have much else to say about this one. I lost my spot. But what I'm getting at is that here, bound by the mortal concept that we know as time, most people seem to always be moving quickly and have something of a vital importance that must be done right now. How many times have you guys heard the phrase, there's not enough time in a day? Imagine if we could all just drop all of that and enjoy whatever's happening right now, just do something fun with no consequence, because things don't start falling apart when we stop. That is one of several images of heaven that I have in my head. So what do you guys think about that? That's kind of a longer one, big, huge thing, because I had to explain a couple things about what I wrote. But what does that make you guys feel? Oh, yeah.
So that's kind of the vibes that respond from the example. Sometimes things that are pressing on us are not the most. They're just flying back at us, and we do them instead of the most. We don't show our priorities sometimes. They are true.
We are
That's the same note you left on my script, and I was about to read it. But thank you. That's powerful.
In the movie that you're describing, I haven't seen it, but it sounds like they're all approaching death with a viewpoint of fasting.
Mm-hmm. Everyone does, yes.
Based on, I've only got 20 years versus I've got 20 years. Waiting for assets.
Oh, Cameron, that was wonderful. Thank you. Did everyone hear what Cameron just said?
No.
So he said, in the movie, everyone approaches death as if it's the end. But for us, that's just the beginning. Okay, and my last thought. This one's going to require some translation because it's written down in a language I call write it down before I forget it. So it says, how do I get people to like what I like? And in parentheses, it says, the most important command. So the translation. This is referring specifically to a trend in gaming culture where people insult each other for liking things that they themselves don't like. So for example, I'm a huge fan of a series called Mass Effect. But there are a lot of people who don't like it anymore because of the way the series ended. So let's say I'm walking around in my favorite N7 hoodie, which is it's a reference to the game, and I come across Thomas, and Thomas goes, "Ugh, you play that game? You must love only having three colors," which again is a game reference. But that doesn't, what he's done now is he's disregarded me as a person and defined me by liking something that he hates. It's a huge problem in gaming culture that most people are not working on, but I also see this as a tool for learning how we can evangelize. So think of that this way. In my example, Thomas just completely dismissed the possibility of a relationship with another person, me. There it is. Because his pride in hating Mass Effect is more important to him, makes it more important to him that I know what an idiot he thinks I am than trying to find out why I like or love what I do. But if instead of heading into insults, Thomas tries to find out what I love and really tries to see it from my side, then suddenly he's not just some jerk who's riding on the hate train. He may still not like it, but he's not disregarding me anymore because I like something. And I think this is how it applies to us. If we disassociate ourselves from people who openly hate the church or bash on God, then that standard goes unchanged. What if instead we try to understand why they dislike what we love? What if we try to create that chance to form a relationship with someone who may never see Christians in any other positive light? I hope you found your tour through my brain at least a little stimulating. Gives you something to think about, maybe. And if I got really lucky, and I said something that convicted you, or if you just want us to pray over you for something, please come forward now while we sing.